Hello, and welcome to Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else,
a series of conversations with innovative educators at colleges and universities across the country and around the world.
This podcast is produced by faculty and staff in the Center for the Advancement of Teaching and Faculty Development at Xavier University of Louisiana.
And now let's talk about teaching, learning, and everything else.
All right, I'm Bart Everson, and today I'm speaking with Michelle M. Francel of Bryn Mawr University. Bryn Mawr College, where you've been on the faculty since 1986. She's a quantum chemist. She has published in areas ranging from the development of methods for computational chemistry to the structures of topologically intriguing molecules. She was elected a fellow of the American Chemical Society in 2009. And Dr. Francel is also a writer whose essays on science, culture, and policy have appeared at Slate Magazine, in Nature Chemistry, and in several collections. So, Dr. Francel, thank you for speaking with me this morning.
Well, thank you for having me.
Great. And I wanted to open the discussion just by talking about a recent experience I had. I had stumbled onto an article which made some assertions that seemed a little suspect to me. Frankly, it seemed like pseudoscience. It linked to what looked like a peer-reviewed journal, an article there, but the article I was actually looking at seemed to make all these kind of assumptions and put a spin on things that didn't really seem fully supported by that. And so I started looking around at the website on which it was published. It was something called Science 2.0, and it got me to wondering if this was, you know, a reputable and legitimate venue. And then I asked myself, well, how can I even tell the difference as a layman, as somebody who doesn't really have a whole lot of formal training in the sciences? How can I make that determination? And that also got me to thinking, if I'm having trouble as somebody who's been around the block a few times, what about young people today? What about our students who are looking at information like this? And so that got me looking around the internet for people who've been thinking about this and writing about it, and that led me to you. And now we're talking to each other.
Well, I mean, you're starting by asking really the right question, which is this reliable information? Who put it out there? All those things that we say to our students that we want them to think about when they pick up any source, right? Who wrote it? Why was it written? What audience was it written for? So as soon as you start asking those questions, you're already, it's a little bit of a vaccination, I think, against pseudoscience.
Well, good. Now, keeping in mind that some of our audience are, of course, well-versed in the sciences, but some, like me, are not. I'm wondering if you could just give us a kind of a working definition for what is pseudoscience anyway, and why does it matter?
So pseudoscience is usually defined as something that is cloaked in scientific language, looks like it might be science, but in some ways is a satire on science, intentional or otherwise. So it will have exaggerated claims, untestable claims. It will link to anecdote rather than data. And it often will be very closed to evaluation from people outside the field or even in the field. So you might have someone talking about vaccines but refusing to talk to anyone who knows anything about vaccines, for example. I mean, that's one of the really hot topics. Often it is around hot topics, things like climate change, things like vaccines, like what do we eat. And I think it's really important for our students to give them the tools to be evaluative of these things, even if they're not going to be scientists. I teach at a liberal arts college, so, you know, maybe a third of my students will go on to be scientists, but, you know, two-thirds of them won't. But I want them to leave having a bit of that scientific imagination, able to look at something and imagine how a scientist would see it and read it.
Right. Well, you know, one of the promises of the internet has been that it will lead to a democratization of media. I think that's one of the phrases that we used to hear anyway. I don't know these days if that has as much currency. But I wonder if the internet plays a role then in the kind of wide open nature of the internet, plays a role in the dissemination of this kind of pseudoscience stuff.
Oh, definitely. I mean, there's a great paper, I want to say it's about 15 years old, written by somebody who modeled the spread of urban myths as disease models. Hmm. So they spread like we talk about things going viral. It really is viral. It works just like a measles virus. And so if you have a good vector, some way to spread it, it spreads well. So I once put a child with chickenpox on an airplane. He had no spots when we got on board, no temperature, but 12 hours later, he had the chickenpox for sure. We, you know, thereby exposed all these people who then got on other airplanes, right? Terrifying. So it's same thing. You put this out on things out on the internet, and now they spread. It's got a great vector for spread. It's also got a great vector for persistency. Right, so you always have the stuff sits there. People say things on the web never go away. We tell students that when we say don't post pictures of yourselves that you don't want an employer to see 5 years later. But it's true of all these rumors as well. So you get things. Relative sent me a picture. Today Mars is going to be as big as the moon. And
yeah.
This shows up every year. Right, so it's got remarkable persistence, and people debunk it every year, and every year it reappears. And Mars is never as big as the moon, right?
Right.
Not in the sky. There is a point in the universe where that is true, but it's nowhere on Earth. So it's that sort of amplification and persistence that the internet gives us. But the flip side is that it also gives you access to the good sources. It's just being able to tell the good sources from the urban myth sources.
Yeah, that's very interesting. It seems like it raises a lot of questions about authority and legitimacy.
It does, and authority is something that lots of people will claim based on anecdote, but authority, when it comes to science, also has to do with training and experience. And I think that our current sort of do-it-yourself atmosphere, I mean, I can now, you know, put a film up on YouTube. And sometimes people do that and it goes viral and wonderful things happen. But it also means that there's no gatekeeping involved. And we don't like to think about gatekeeping as a good idea. But
right.
When we have a limited attention span for stuff, we do need some gatekeeping, right? It's nice to have the movies that still show in the theaters or that you can stream. They're generally better than what you would find in a random grab from YouTube. Not always,
right.
But still might be better. So there's some balance between having some authority that's based on training and experience versus an authority that's just claimed, you know, my child had the chicken pox. This does not make me an authority on the chicken pox. But people will claim that. And so it is a piece of this is about authority. And as someone who teaches science, I want to help my students claim some of their own authority, right? They now have some training.
Yeah.
It might not be a lot, but you want to claim the authority that you have and helping them do that in a way that is accessible not only to them, but helps them be accessible to the people they're going to talk to, whether that's the relatives over the holiday dinner who are going to say, did you read that there's a yoga mat chemical in bread? or whether it's going to be in reading something that's tangential to their field, or whether it comes to making decisions about who they vote for. Right? You want them informed in all those places.
Right, absolutely. Well, you have written about this topic a number of times, and that's how I found you. And I'm curious to know how you personally got interested in this area, in this topic.
My students. So I started a long time ago. I try to, in the classroom, do a lot of things that are context-rich. So when we talk about oxidation reduction, which is a classic topic in the introductory chemistry course, I talk about what's the largest natural disaster in the United States, which turns out not to be a hurricane, although in New Orleans it may feel like that, but
right.
It's rust. We spend billions and billions of dollars on rust. Bridges fall down. All sorts of terrible things happen because of rust, which is an oxidation reduction process. So the course that I teach is very much embedded in what's happening in the real world and how does that relate to these classic topics. So one day I had a student appear, and she had something printed off the internet, and it said, it says that here's a test for telling if there's lead in your red lipstick. And so we talked about it as a class, and I said to them, does this make sense based on what you know? And it involved taking a gold ring and running it across the lipstick, and if the paper turned black that you put the lipstick mark on, then there was definitely lead, which sounds like, so here's the pseudoscience part, right? It sounds like oxidation reduction, where often you get things where a metal shows up. So you'll see a black mark, or you'll see rust, you'll see kind of red marks. Color changes go with oxidation and reduction. And it's meant to tell you that, except I said to them, what do you know about gold? And they said, oh, almost nothing will oxidize gold. I said, ah. And from there, they could, in fact, they had all the necessary tools from that first year chemistry course to debunk this. And that got me interested. So then I began to do more of that in the classroom with them. The food babe is great because a lot of the stuff she posts is easily debunkable by any student with a few, you know, not even a semester's worth of general chemistry.
The food babe.
The food babe, who has an army of people.
This is like an internet personality.
Definitely. It's an internet personality. She has a book out. She has YouTube videos up. She's pretty easy to find. But from my perspective, she's great because you don't need a lot to be able to figure out what she's saying makes no sense. And so I began introducing more and more of this into the class, and then students bring it into class. So, in fact, the food babe appeared in my class the first time because a student came in waving this and saying, I know this isn't right.
Huh.
And then someone else saw something and they said, you have to write about this for the blog, which I did, and then eventually wrote an article for Slate about the food babe and her book and what she's claiming. So that's how I first got into this, is in fact through the classroom and through helping develop students' abilities at an early stage to distinguish between science and pseudoscience.
Great. Well, and I'd like to talk a little bit more about the classroom, but first I kind of wanted to ask if, you know, it's my experience anyway, that people kind of become very attached to their to these urban myths, urban legends, incorrect assumptions, whatever we want to call them, pseudoscience and the like. And that they don't take kindly often to someone who is debunking. So I'm wondering if in your writing and your criticism that you've put out there, have you gotten a lot of pushback?
Oh yeah, people will tell you, you know, you're just a shill for fill in the blank, some big industry. You know, you must take money from Monsanto, or you must take money from here. You know, I don't. I get a salary from the college. That's it. The notion that people are going to have these entrenched ideas, some people's ideas are so entrenched you just can't get at them.
Right.
But some people, you have that kind of moment, especially if you have relationship with them. So the Yale Project on Cognition, Cultural Cognition, talks about this, that if you know me, and I tell you, oh, gee, you know, this bit about the yoga mat chemical, you know, makes no sense, then you might be more likely to believe me than you would if I just walked up to some person on the street. I was at a conference and somebody was sitting next to me and talking to me about the food babe, someone I don't know, and I thought, should I say something? And I thought, no. because I think her, you know, her ideas were clearly so entrenched and we had no relationship to build that on. I have relationships with my students, and so there is a lot of pushback. If you look at some of the comments on the articles I've written for Slate, they can be pretty interesting and pretty direct and telling you, you know, clearly you don't know anything.
Yeah.
You just need a thick skin.
Yeah, I guess so. I would imagine you do. Well, it is very concerning to me, and I think hopefully to some of our listeners, the state of dialogue nationally that we have on issues of science. I read a letter to the editor just a few days ago in our local paper here in New Orleans. The writer of the letter didn't seem to have any qualifications, but was very adamant in insisting that there is not only is there no such thing as global warming caused by humans, but there's also no such thing as a greenhouse effect. You know, that just on the carbon dioxide does not cause a greenhouse effect, and he, you know, strung together some allegations that kind of sounded scientific. And said, you know, this proves that this isn't the case. And I was frankly astonished that they published this letter, because it really didn't even make any sense. But I guess anything goes.
Right, pretty much anything goes. And I mean, certainly my local paper, the Philadelphia paper, has published things that are equally that are scientific fact. And you know, you're entitled to your opinion about things, but you're not entitled to your own facts. So CO2 absorbs in the infrared, period. No matter what else you say, it does. And if that heat is happening in an atmosphere, that's greenhouse, period. This person made fun of how many pounds of carbon you got out of burning a gallon of gasoline. It's, you know, you burn a pound of gasoline and you get, you know, so many pounds of carbon dioxide, and it's far more than you would expect. And the person is like, ha, 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 don't you know about conservation of mass? And, of course, anyone who knows anything about combustion in chemistry knows it combines with oxygen in the air, which has a lot of mass. You just don't think about it because you know, move your hands and you don't feel it. But, in fact, there is, you know, 10 pounds, slightly more than that, pounds of pressure, 14 pounds of pressure over our heads all the time from the atmosphere. We just don't recognize it as mass. And so this person is mocking scientists about something that's a very basic fact that he's missing. And again, it showed up in the paper, and several people, you know, wrote in to say this person needs to go back to, you know, elementary science before making such claims. And that's the hard part, because people don't want to stop and say, on what authority are you saying this? Or even to go up, you know, look up the chemical equation for the burning of gasoline. That's on the internet. it's a source, you know, that you can use to find that sort of information as well. But
right.
it's you know, it is very hard, because people will state things that are factually untrue. And I think we need to do a better job of pushing back in the public sphere. And I certainly have argued that I think scientists should take some responsibility for doing that, and for letting, you know, the media know that it's unacceptable to publish incorrect facts.
Well, that seems like also an opportunity perhaps for student engagement. So, you know, these are some really critical issues, it seems like, with a lot of the things that are going on in our world, in our society. It seems like awareness and literacy in this regard is just critically important. So what, you know, what can we do in our teaching, in our classes, to engage these issues? Do you have any tips for people who maybe are just kind of getting started to bring this into their teaching?
So one thing that I do in the science realm is to think about sort of what are the big ideas that I'm trying to get across that you can use on your own to make decisions about how molecules behave. So I'm teaching chemistry. So part of it is sort of isolating these big ideas, because that's what students are going to remember when they go 5 and 10 years down the line, I hope. They're not going to remember the details of this reaction or that reaction, but what I want them to have is these sort of major tools. And I think isolating them and helping students see how they play out in the science is one thing you can do. I think getting students to bring in these questions to the classroom and then helping them see that they have the tools to unravel them and assess the sources is helpful. And, of course, you know, that's what we're always trying to do with our students in the classroom. It can be more helpful to bring in the things like the lipstick example than it can be sometimes to bring in global warming or to bring in radiation or other things at first, because those things are less charged in the overall conversation. Nobody's going to argue about the lipstick example. We could debunk it ourselves and say, oops, you know, not true. There may be lead in your lipstick, but this isn't how you find it out. But
it's smaller in a way.
It's smaller in a way, and it's less emotionally charged. But I think we don't do our students a service if we completely ignore the emotionally charged issues either, especially at the college level. And so, you know, we talk about why carbon dioxide is a greenhouse gas in my course. We will talk about radiation and nuclear power and nuclear accidents in my class. And students may agree or disagree about what policies you might make based on the body of information we have, but at least we can begin to build their awareness that there is a body of information out there that is authoritative and understood, and from that you can begin to make decisions. You know, for me, it's always a balance of establishing trust in my classroom. It's back to that cultural cognition. You know, if I just stand up there and assert something without any relationship to my class, no built-up trust, I think they, you know, just like the person next to me at the conference, they wouldn't, I think, have ears to hear what I have to say.
All right. Well, thank you so much for sharing your perspectives on all this. It's kind of time to wind this up. We do have the, when we publish this podcast, we can put on some links there to some of the things that you've spoken about in your blog and so forth, some of your articles that will help people find more information.
Well, thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, well, it's been a pleasure, and since I am speaking to you here in late December, I will say happy holidays and a happy new year.
Thank you so much. Happy new year to you as well.
All right. Take care.
Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening to this installment of Teaching, Learning, and Everything Else.
For more information, please visit our website at cat.zula.edu.
That's C-A-T dot XULA.edu.
Until next time, keep on teaching, learning, and everything else.